Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Now, I'm very excited for this guest. Paul Tremblay is one of the most terrifying horror writers of his generation. And I was out with surgery recently to my face and it meant I couldn't laugh out loud. The doctor told me to read some good horror stories. I did. And it was this new novel, Horror Movie, which I found after extraordinary reviews from the New York Times and beyond. Paul Tremblay is on the line from Massachusetts. Good morning.
Good morning. Jeez, I hope you're fully recovered.
No, it was very, very minor, I can assure you. But as we get into it, people understand that it was a bizarre choice because it's about masks and there's a bit of body horror and so on.
Yeah.
Now, I presume there are people listening who are thinking, oh, horror books, these are not for me. But there's so much more to this story, Paul, that kind of the confines of the genre don't really allow for. Can you give them an idea of what this story is about?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, the story centers around a film that a group of 20-something-year-olds made in 1993. You know, and something happened on set towards the end of filming that prevented it from making it to screen. Now, fast forward to now, you know, a little over 30 years later, the man who played a character called the Thin Kid is narrating his sort of audio memoir to us, the readers. And he's, you know, discussing not only his experience on set, his experiences maybe 15 years and then 30 years later. He's narrating or he's telling us about the attempted Hollywood big budget reboot of the movie. At the same time, the story is intercut with the entire screenplay from the original movie. So, you know, all sorts of secrets and layers are sort of revealed.
So there are three timelines here, which should be confusing and it should be difficult to follow, but somehow it's not. How did you manage to actually achieve that?
Yeah, that's in some ways it's kind of hard for me to answer, if only because I wrote, you know, the book that you read, that's the order in which I wrote everything. That's just kind of how I work as a writer. I wish I could jump around and, like, I certainly didn't write the whole screenplay first or anything like that. I sort of, you know, I wrote each bit as it went. And I don't know, I just, in the moment, you sort of go by feel, like, you know, you plan ahead a little bit. But I don't know, for me, it felt like this was the best way for, you know, the we're talking about the real readers of the book now, not the readers of the audiobook.
Yes.
From the Thin Kid. But yeah, the to me, it seemed like the best and most interesting way for it to unfold.
I mean, it's called Horror Movie, and it kind of feels like a movie. That's what you were going for, I think.
Yeah, I wanted to try to. I wanted to try to mix, you know, the affect of both, you know, reading and, you know, and viewing a movie. You know, which, so that was a fun challenge in book form. You know, when you say, you know, you open up by saying, "Oh, people like, oh, I wouldn't necessarily want to read something like this," because most people's reactions are because of horror movies, right? You know, if you say, "Oh, I just read this thing and it was horror," in their minds, I think most people think of, I don't know, Friday the 13th or whatever sort of movie started them as a child, and they're like, "No, like I don't want to read that." I wanted to sort of juxtapose like the idea of reading, you know, you're reading a horror novel, but it's about this movie, and trying to mix the different affects.
What is it really about? Because the mask at the center of the movie, and as a result, the story, which seems to follow the Thin Kid or the unnamed narrator throughout, so that obviously would lend itself to identity and kind of insecurity about our bodies. Is that what you're doing?
the Thin Kid, who's never named, you know, physically, he's pretty much me. you know, when I was in my early 20s, you know, painfully skinny and bad skin, and I even had scoliosis as a child, so, like, I had surgery for a curved spine.
Wow.
Yeah, so physically, just, you know, I remember feeling somewhat, you know, if not monstrous, certainly not like everybody else. You know, I was really interested, you know, in particular the filmmakers, this group of, you know, this group of five or six people. They certainly weren't going to be rich for making this, you know, really disturbing movie. They wanted to make it because there was something that drove them to make it. So a lot of the book to me is an exploration of sort of the collaborative process. You know, what are they willing to do for art? Is it worth it? You know, where is that line of where it's worth it or not? Like, and what risks are they willing to take? Obviously, financially, mental health, and, you know, even physical.
You mentioned scoliosis that you went through. What was that like being a kid? How are other children towards you because of that condition?
Yeah, so that condition didn't really get discovered until later my high school years. So, geez, I was like, 16-ish when they really discovered that my upper spine was super curved.
Really?
I don't know. I wasn't like a very popular kid. Part of that was just me feeling sort of very, self-conscious, et cetera. So, yeah, no, high school for me, like for so many people, wasn't a very pleasant experience.
Is it a useful mine, that high school experience, for horror?
Oh, absolutely. It's funny, I guess I'm getting older. I'm losing memories of certain things and certain details. But what has stayed with me and continues to stay with me is sort of the emotional life I had as a teenager and as a young adult. For some reason, that's never left me. And, I often visit it in book form.
It's incredible, those kind of little horrors that we just carry around with us all of our days,
right?
Pass it along. I mean, it's just kind of endless, isn't it?
Yeah. The novel previous to horror movie was called The Paul Bearers Club. And in that book, I really dug into the scoliosis experience. And so many of my books end up being, somewhat autobiographical, as is the case, I'm sure, for most writers. And after I wrote The Paul Bearers Club, I was like, oh, no, I think I emptied the bucket on this one. I kind of used everything. But the fun part was to discover, the bucket slowly fills back up and there's still stuff there that you haven't written about. It seems like, hopefully it'll seem like an endless well until it's time to stop writing.
I think another thing that will attract people to horror movie, the book, is that you're having a real pop at the film industry here, aren't you?
Yeah, that was a fun little happenstance. That when I was in the early stages of writing the novel, I happened to be going through the adaptation process. My book, The Cabin at the End of the World, being adapted into the M. Night Shyamalan film, Knock at the Cabin, the grammatically incorrect title, Knock at the Cabin. So there's definitely a lot of my anecdotal Hollywood experience that gets refracted and put into the book.
This was the film was a $25 million movie directed by M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah.
So your experience wasn't Knock at the Cabin, grammar aside. What frustrated you most about the whole experience?
Oh, I mean, on the whole, it was an amazing experience. I mean, the frustrations, well, some of it was just like strange observations, like, Hollywood is such a weird place. a lot of my experiences with prior attempts at things getting made went into it, where you would hear from producers and they would tell you all the things you wanted to hear and sound like your best friend. And then you'd never hear from them again. But to answer your question specifically, in the marketing lead up to the release of the novel was the most, or excuse me, the release of the movie was the most frustrating part, because they were actively hiding that the book was an adaptation for a whole host of reasons that I won't necessarily ascribe their motivations to, even though I feel like I know those motivations. But, in the end, movie got made. It paid for some of my daughter's college tuition. So a happy ending.
Surely that's not the end of your relationship with Hollywood, I would imagine, because there's a lot of anticipation about any time you put out a book.
Yeah, no, I hope not. Even though as cynical as I made, the thin kid and his responses to Hollywood. Yeah, please, someone pay me, make something.
And Hollywood is kind of the inverse to the publishing world, in that you get all the yeses in Hollywood, is it? And then it's a...
Yes.
What's that kind
Sorry,
of...
Sorry, I mean to interrupt. I was agreeing with you. Yeah, yeah. The old saw is like, I'm publishing, it's no, 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 until it's yes. And in Hollywood, it's yes, 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 until it's no.
Oh, it's yes and no. Okay, they get the rejection at the end. Very curious.
Yeah. I will say, like, I sort of understood a little bit more why when I visited the set for Knock at the Cabin for a couple of days, and I could just see, like, the army of people that they had and this giant set that they'd built and all these people that were employees. Like, oh, this is a snapshot of what, $25 million. So, like, the idea of, the amounts of money that movies spend, made me realize a little bit, like, okay, I can sort of see why people are hesitant to finally say that yes, because that's a large amount of money that then has to be invested.
Extraordinary investment. All the novels feature the house you grew up in. What was that house like? That's in Massachusetts somewhere.
Yeah, so I grew up in a town called Beverly, Massachusetts, which is about 20 miles north of Boston, and it borders the much more famous Salem, Massachusetts. I grew up in a sort of like a lower middle class sort of house. My father was a factory worker. He worked at Parker Brothers, which was the game company, made Monopoly and Nerf and all that fun stuff. And my mom split time between being a stay-at-home mom or sometimes she worked as a bank teller. Yeah, the kind of economic family that really wouldn't be able to exist now in the current sort of economy. House was, a small, by American standards, not European standards, small, probably like a 1,500 square foot, three bedrooms, one and a half bath, for people who I think who don't move around a lot as children and live in one place, which was my experience, you know, that house was, you know, I lived there since I was 4 years old until, you know, I left after college. You know, that place in a weird way becomes like my memory palace. That's the place where like you spend so much time daydreaming about what's going to be like as an adult. And you first sort of discover the outside world from this little inside insular place. So I don't know. In my writing, I just find myself going back to that house. Almost comically so. Maybe it's a reflection of just me being lazy and not wanting to describe the blueprint of another house. But
yeah. It remains bright in your imagination. Tremblay, that's a French-Canadian name, I believe.
Yes, it is. Yeah, my father's side of the family is French-Canadians and my mom's side of the family, British and Irish, Murtagh.
We'd say Murtagh. Yeah. Murtagh, there are loads of Murtaghs. Still in Ireland. Have you been over to this side of the Atlantic?
I have not been to Ireland yet, but I'm dying to go. Hopefully one of these years I get to go back over.
I think it's like sacrilege that a horror writer has not been to Ireland. We gave the world Halloween. We invented Halloween. I don't know if you know that. A pagan festival that went to America. The Americans made it better, I will say, and then we brought it back, the American version as well. Do you celebrate Halloween?
Yes, although like I don't go like over the top. When I was younger, like we would sometimes go into Salem, Massachusetts for Halloween.
Oh yeah.
And that's become like they'll have hundreds of thousands of people come just to walk the streets of Salem. Salem is sort of a weird mix of kitsch, of horror, of witch lore, of this weird like celebration of the state sanctioned death of 19 people.
Yes,
you know, and there's like all the history as well.
Yeah. Halloween is nice and abstract. As opposed to witch trials.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, some of Salem is quite beautiful and some of it is just quite strange. It's almost like not quite Hollywood, but like a Hollywoodization of sort of like one of the historical cities of Massachusetts.
They say that in Ireland we do death extremely well. So I don't know if you heard of the wake, which I presume they do in American Catholic families.
Yes.
But in Ireland it got that little extra special touch. We celebrate death and we sit around the corpse. Some people touch the corpse, of course, as a blessing, drink, tell stories, and have some cake. Perfectly normal around a dead body.
Yeah, the Boston area is quite Catholic. And, you know, I'm not a practicing Catholic, but sort of grew up that way. So, yeah, I've been to my share of wakes. Didn't do any body touching, though.
You have to come here.
No, we definitely have, you know, the open casket, you know, people visiting, milling around, talking. Yeah.
I must ask you as well about, because Stephen King obviously is still the master of horror and he's a great admirer of yours.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the fact that he, you know, reads and likes my stuff is, you know, one of the top things of my writing career, you know, especially when he first read a book called A Head Full of Ghosts.
Yeah.
I still remember the date. It was August 18th, 2015, where he tweeted about loving A Head Full of Ghosts and how it scared the hell out of him.
It scared the hell out of Stephen King, your novel.
Yeah. Right. No, it's crazy. You know, we exchange emails pretty frequently. You know, we're both fans of the Boston Red Sox. You know, so we check in with complaints about how the baseball team is doing and well, at this point, how they're not doing so well. But
what kind of things scare you now, Paul Tremblay?
Oh, geez, everything. I'm a lifelong sort of card-carrying scaredy cat. Like as a kid, I was, you know, afraid of the dark and just, you know, I had so many nightmares and I used to sleep with stuffed animals around my head and, you know, I don't sleep with stuffed animals around my head anymore. But
I hope not.
I definitely still move faster if I'm coming up through the basement.
Really?
You know, if I'm home alone at night, not above going to bed with like one of the lights on in the room or something like that.
That's imagination, isn't it? Going.
Yeah, as a horror writer, I mean, it's obviously useful, but in the moment, it's not so fun.
Why do you think we love horror? Why do you think we do it to ourselves? Put us through scary films, put us through novels like yours. Why do we do it for entertainment?
That's a great question. You know, I think it's, for me, I don't know, for me, horror feels, especially when it's an entertainment form, what I've come, you know, I wouldn't have been able to articulate this as a child, but like why I would watch a movie that would give me nightmares. I think part of it was this recognition between me as the viewer or the reader and the creator. It's like, oh, they feel that way too. And it's just that almost like human connection and human communication, even if it's something that's like utterly grim, you know, and disturbing. I take like a measure of hope from it because it's like, oh yeah, they see this too. They see and understand these terrible things too. And, you know, I feel a little bit less sort of alone because of it.
That is a perfect answer. Horror Movie by Paul Tremblay is out now. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun.
51551. That's our text.
From the North Text Studio, followed by your message to 80889.